This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you in part by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com. Well, welcome everybody. I am an evangelical, and more importantly, I am an old evangelical. And the reason I say that is not because I'm necessarily completely old, chronologically, getting there, but it's because I like to go back to what has been called the old paths. The old biblical kind of Christian isn't new. I'm not hip. I'm not trying to be relevant. I'm not trying to be cutting edge and all the rest and all of these fads and all of these trends that tend to sucker us in and draw us in, and we got to be new and different and bebop and we have to zippity pow and all the rest. We all have to be wonderful and exciting. Not me. I don't want to be wonderful and exciting. I want to be an old evangelical, capital O, capital E. That's it. And I also call myself a Christian. There are many different terms that I use. But if I am reading the Washington Post and other mainstream media outlets recently, and it has been going on for months, I have seen nothing but these nonstop articles from people on why we need to get rid of the term evangelical. Get rid of it. We got to get rid of it. And here is how I can summarize it. It isn't just one person saying this. It's been a multitude of people saying this. I'm an evangelical and I don't want to be associated with that term anymore. It comes down to two factors. This is the common denominator in all of these articles. It comes down to evangelicals are now associated with Trump. That's one reason we need to get rid of the word evangelical. And so evangelical means you're a Republican. So we got to jettison the term. Or the second reason is because evangelical is now associated with being white. Now, if you were really to look at that on its face, you would say, especially in the case of the second designation, that that seems rather racist. I know we're not supposed to believe that anybody can be racist if they're saying something about a white person versus a black person or an Asian person or a Hispanic person. I happen to believe that if you judge people based on their skin color, that that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for any race to do it to any other race. We're all people created in the image and likeness of God. And so we all ought to treat each other as if we are all valuable because we are created in the image of God, and judge people based on the content of their character. A wise man said that once, and I happen to believe that. So here comes the Washington Post with this new article from Amy Julia Becker. I must confess, I don't know who she is, but she's the latest one. Why I am ditching the label evangelical in the Trump era. And one of her lines was, evangelical to many people primarily conjures white Republican, not first a bearer of good news. I would argue, actually, having followed the news with great interest and great detail over the last many years, that the reason evangelical has been tainted as political is because, in large measure, that's what the media have been calling us. In fact, if you go to Google or any other search engine and you type in evangelical, at least this has been the case for the last several months, every single story that comes up with the word evangelical is negative and going after evangelicals over Trump. Most of them anyway. They're always negative. And I think this is an interesting point. Here's why. When you go back to the New Testament, did you know that the word Christian appears only three times in the New Testament? This is one writer who's pointing this out. And the Christians were first called such in Antioch, but it was generally used as a derogatory term. The pagans started calling the followers of Jesus Christians. So it was a derogatory term. Now, when you get to the term evangelical, I know many people have pointed out evangelical doesn't mean much anymore because it's been so watered down and so many people fall under that label of evangelical. You go back to some of the standards, for example, adopted by the NAE, the National Association of Evangelicals. And here's how they defined evangelicals. People who say the Bible is the highest authority for what I believe. People who say it is very important for me personally to encourage non-Christians to trust Jesus Christ as their Savior. people who say Jesus Christ's death on the cross is the only sacrifice that could remove the penalty of my sin. And finally, those who say only those who trust in Jesus Christ alone as their Savior receive God's free gift of eternal salvation. They call this a robust standard, at least Ed Stetzer did, formerly of Lifeway, who helped craft these designations for evangelicals. He points out evangelicals are diverse in regards to politics, but I guess that's all out the window according to people like this woman in the Washington Post. No, it's associated with your whiteness and your political conservatism or your political Trumpism, because they keep saying and reminding people Donald Trump is not truly a conservative, even though he's done a number of conservative things since getting into office. All of this is very confusing, but I think it can be whittled down to a couple of really important points. I have been a critic, for example, of churches and this trend that has happened over the last several decades. We need to change our name because it is a barrier. I get tired of that because I think that is a never-ending trend. You will never stop changing your name if you start getting paranoid about people not liking your name. Now, I'm not saying that is never something that you should do. Sometimes it is appropriate to change a name or update a name over time because it comes up with a different connotation over time due to various circumstances. Fine. But the churches that change their name, we want to take Baptist out of our name. We want to take Presbyterian out of our name. We want to take any sort of reference to the Bible out of our name, because that would be a barrier to new people coming in. They have some sort of an issue with XYZ denomination. And if you put the denominational name in the title of the church, then people won't come. And I have always thought that was not the way to go. As I said, it's not that it's never the way to go. I just think in general, you're never going to win that game. If all you're ever worried about is turning people off, and this came up recently, by the way, because at Princeton, they had changed their name from, what was it, Princeton Evangelical Fellowship to now Princeton Christian Fellowship. Scott McKnight wrote about this. He's another one saying we need to bury the term evangelical. But he wrote about this, and yeah, it was the Princeton Evangelical Fellowship, which changed its name to Princeton Christian Fellowship because of the baggage around the evangelical label. Well, if you're constantly worrying about baggage around evangelical, next thing you know, you're going to start calling yourself something else, and then they'll figure out that maybe you vote a way they don't like, and then they'll want you to change that too. Let's just call each other Christians. Right, well, we are Christians, but a lot of people co-opt the term Christian who don't believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. A lot of people co-opt Christian who don't believe in the substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ. There are a lot of people who co-opt Christian who don't even believe the gospel once for all delivered to the saints. So what in the world does Christian mean anymore? If anybody can adopt that term, then anybody can adopt evangelical. The reason I like evangelical is because evangelical goes back to the gospel. The gospel. In fact, the Encyclopedia Britannica points this out, talking about the original Protestants, who, of course, were the Lutherans 500 years ago. They point out the term Lutheran, which appeared as early as 1519, was coined by Luther's opponents. So there we have another derogatory term. You guys are the Lutherans. The self-designation of Luther's followers was evangelical. That is, centered on the gospel, centered on the euangelion, which means good news. And as far as I'm concerned, if it was good enough for Luther's followers and the early Christians 500 years ago, it's good enough for me. And if people don't like the term, I'll slap old in front of it to point out that there's nothing cool and trendy about me. I just want to follow the old paths, as Scripture says, but I'm not going to change my name. And I'm not going to be ashamed of the gospel. And I recognize how the term has been watered down. But what I think happens is when we begin to follow these people who say, now you can't call yourself this anymore. I'm just tired of being told I can't call myself X, Y, or Z. I can't call myself an evangelical because people might think I'm white. I am white. But when did I ever say, or when did any other white Christian say, the only Christians out there who can hold to evangelical beliefs are white people? That's not true. Clearly. And Trump doesn't have anything to do with being evangelical. It just so happens that a lot of evangelicals said, we don't want Hillary to be voted in. And so they happen to vote for Donald Trump. Many of them reluctantly, by the way, and many of them making that decision at the last minute. So what does that have to do with the gospel? Nothing. Nothing. It comes down to, bottom line, a lot of liberals saying, we don't want to be called evangelicals. Okay, fine. Call yourself something else. I have no problem with that. But as for me and my house, we're going to stay old evangelicals, because we believe in the good news. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. A lot to come. Stay with us.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
We've talked before about this bizarre, unconstitutional new trend with liberals in Washington imposing a de facto religious test for public service. Last time it was Bernie Sanders attacking a Christian nominee for believing Jesus is the only way to God. Somehow that was Islamophobic. Now liberal senators in the Judiciary Committee are doing the same with Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals nominee Amy Barrett. Senator Dianne Feinstein from California was concerned that Christian, quote, dogma lived loudly within her. This is preposterous. Article 6, Section 3 of the Constitution is clear. No religious test shall ever be applied as a condition for public service in the United States.
Devout Catholics shouldn't be judges because of their strong faith. At least that's what Senator Dianne Feinstein thinks. Fight for religious freedom with your voice of influence, Concerned Women for America. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you in part by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. Well, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit has now declared a cross-shaped veterans memorial unconstitutional. The memorial in question is called the Bladensburg Memorial, or the Peace Cross, which has for nearly a century, in honor of 49 men, stood there for those who died during World War I. And we're going to hear more about this outrageous decision now from Ken Klukowski, Senior Counsel and Director of Strategic Affairs at First Liberty Institute, which is representing the American Legion in this case. Ken, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Janet, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right, bring us up to speed on this. What about this memorial is unconstitutional? A 40-foot memorial who stood there for the better part of 100 years is all of a sudden unconstitutional?
In 1925, the mothers of 49 World War I soldiers from Prince George's County in Maryland wanted soldiers who gave the ultimate sacrifice on the battlefields of Europe, serving and protecting this country. Their mothers wanted to honor them, and so the American Legion erected this memorial modeled off of a traditional World War One battlefield tombstone. That's what the cross shape here is. You can find thousands of them in Europe from World War One and World War Two. So this cross shaped memorial, which again is a grave marker traditionally for battlefields, that was erected with the words valor, courage, devotion, etc., and with a plaque at the foot of it that explains what this is all about, that this is to honor these wonderful veterans and their families who, again, made the ultimate sacrifice. It was built on private land, Janet, but decades later, when the government was expanding the nearby road, this parcel of land was acquired by the government under eminent domain. And so now, though it was set up on private land, through no fault of the American Legion or these families, suddenly it ended up on government land. That was still fine for more than half a century after that, until just a few years ago, a militant atheist organization, the American Humanist Association, sued, saying that this honorable memorial is somehow a violation of the Constitution's establishment clause.
Good grief. Well, a couple of years ago, I understand that they lost the case, and now this is a reversal of that previous decision. So how was it the court 2 years ago had indicated that it was not a primarily religious purpose here with this memorial, but now the Fourth Circuit has reversed it? What's the difference of opinion there?
That was the district court, the U.S. District Court for the Court of Maryland. And in fact, a judge there who, you know, some people try and look at these things through the eyes of different political parties, a judge there who, in fact, was appointed by President Bill Clinton, ruled in favor of the memorial and said that a reasonable person would understand this for what it is and not as some sort of the government's promotion of religion. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit reversed, saying that this cross is clearly an endorsement of Christianity, and therefore saying that it just violates the Establishment Clause. Well, what I think is so important about it, respectfully, we completely disagree with the panel decision. The dissenting judge in that case was also a democratically appointed judge who said that and includes moving quotes talking about how reasonable people would not see that when you have these 49 people who paid the ultimate sacrifice protecting this country and its constitution, that he said in no way is it inconsistent with the, does it violate the letter or spirit of that Constitution's Establishment Clause to just honor them in this respectful fashion.
Wow. Well, that's good. But, of course, the dissenting judge didn't prevail here. It was the majority opinion. Now, this is interesting. One of the things that has come up in some of the news stories that I've read can indicate that the size of the cross was partly why they rendered the decision they did. What does the size matter? What, I mean, it's big, so it must represent Christianity more than a small grave marker. What is that about?
You're going to exactly the right point, and that is that, you know, if a 30-foot cross is constitutional, it doesn't become an assault on the supreme law of the land just because you make it 10 feet higher.
Right.
I think that in doing so, the judges in the majority, that they're latching on a distinction that does not make any constitutional difference. I think they did that to try and indicate that, to try and say, but I think unpersuasively, that this decision does not somehow endanger Arlington National Cemetery. We would say that it does, which is also under the jurisdiction of the Fourth Circuit, because it's in Virginia, that's part of this court. But even within Arlington, there are several large freestanding crosses, the Argonne Cross, the Canadian Cross. So even if that did make a difference, there would still be several parts of Arlington National Cemetery that would be debatably unconstitutional under the Fourth Circuit's decision this week.
Well, that's extremely disturbing, because then if this turns out the wrong way in the long run, then it could set up a showdown over the removal of those big crosses at Arlington National Cemetery.
I would think that that's a very realistic danger at this point. So
if
for that reason, we are pressing forward. We are not giving up this fight.
Good. Well, here's a question I have for you, Ken. Maybe you can explain this a little bit, because I've never understood this. When you have these humanist and secularist and atheist organizations suing over these sorts of things, cross markers, cross memorials, and these sorts of cases that have come up, how in the world can a gravesite or memorial marker be considered an establishment of religion if no religious activities are conducted or associated with them?
Because they're operating off a misbegotten legal test that the Supreme Court has recently fully moved away from, but the Fourth Circuit didn't recognize that in this decision. And that is, for a quarter century, the Supreme Court started to go sideways in the 1960s when it comes to what the Establishment Clause means.
Yes.
In 1971, the court tried to put together a grand test that would fix everything. It just made it worse. And finally, they revised it one final time in 1989 into what many of your listeners will be familiar with, the endorsement test, under which a court asks whether a hypothetical reasonable observer somewhere out in the, you know, out in the mists would think that the government was endorsing religion. That test is an incorrect test. It is totally divorced from the historical understanding of the Establishment Clause. But for the years that it has held sway, that's where the Establishment Clause became a wrecking ball that knocked down so many longstanding expressions of faith. Whenever the government does anything that could lead some hypothetical person to say, I think the government's endorsing religion, a court could strike it down as unconstitutional.
Right. So some random person in the ether determines I don't like it, as in an atheist or a humanist. That just sets up all sorts of court cases like the one that's before the court now.
It certainly did. And again, the endorsement test, which was adopted by only a single vote, it was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court in 1989. The court would occasionally just completely set it aside. It really started to change course in 2005 when it allowed a longstanding Ten Commandments display in Texas outside the State House to remain in place. But in 2014, in a landmark case, Town of Greece versus Galloway, the Supreme Court started to really tackle the endorsement test. Of course, we had a change in membership on the court. And Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote an opinion just sharply criticizing the endorsement test and saying that the court should return to the historical understanding of the Establishment Clause, which is that it's only violated, the Constitution here is only violated by things that would have been regarded historically in 1791 as an official establishment of religion, or when the government is coercing any person to participate in a religious activity that violates their conscience. And as you just indicated, Janet, I mean, a passive display like this, a memorial, that doesn't coerce anyone. You don't have to look at it if you don't like it.
Exactly. So do you foresee then, Ken, moving forward and trying to get a definitive word from the Supreme Court on this cross memorial issue once and for all, if it gets that far?
The legal team is still, we have two options before us. The legal team is still discussing it, and we have to also discuss it with the clients. The two options at this point are to either petition the full U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit to rehear the case en banc, which means to ask all 15 judges on the court to re-decide the case as a group, or to petition directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. Or you could go from an en banc Fourth Circuit action to the Supreme Court. So the question is whether to go directly to the Supreme Court or whether as an intermediate step to ask for en banc review. Those discussions are ongoing at this time. Final decision will be made in the next few days.
Well, what about the possibility of, I know you said that the land was acquired by the government via eminent domain. Is there any likelihood that the government could just return the land to the private entity and then solve the problem?
If you see the pictures here, in one sense, we'd love to restore religious liberty in America. But in another sense, as lawyers, our obligation is just to win for our clients any way that we can. If a transfer like that would be possible, that would be an alternative way to win the case for the American Legion here, and for the Maryland Commission. But the reality is that if you look at a picture on this, I mean, it is pretty much part of the road setup. So
yeah.
Since the government must continue to own the land that the road is on as public property, if you were to see this visually with your eyes, you would see it would be very hard. I don't know if it's literally impossible, but it would be hard to imagine how this parcel could be ceded back to private land.
Yes, that totally makes sense. That would be very difficult, I would imagine, after that eminent domain to be able to give that land back, given where it stands right now. And you can see that, by the way, Ken, as you mentioned in the pictures that are shown in some of these news reports. Well, we're going to keep an eye out on this case. This is a very important case, and it needs to go the right way. Ken Klukowski from First Liberty Institute. Ken, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much, and we'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Proverbs 6:32 says, a man who commits adultery has no sense. Whoever does so destroys himself. And in Proverbs 7, we read, my son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call insight your intimate friend to keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words. Now, we know right from the Ten Commandments that adultery is sin, and yet it happens and even happens among Christians. The question is, how do you stop an affair before it actually starts? And that's what we're going to tackle today with Dave Carter. He is pastor of counseling ministries at First Evangelical Free Church of Fullerton, California, and his specialty is adultery recovery and prevention. He is out with a new book that we're going to be discussing. It is called Anatomy of an Affair. And it's wonderful to have you here, Dave. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Jen. Looking forward to this.
I am, too. I know this is kind of a tough subject. How big of a problem have you found adultery in the church to be today?
Well, it depends what survey you read, but most people would say the percentages are around 40% of parishioners. And we know approximately that same number of pastors get in trouble in the church. So I think it's underreported among parishioners. We know the American population at large somewhere runs around 50% of women and 60-65% of men.
Wow, that is way higher than I even imagined. That's really at a crisis level, I would say.
Oh, yeah, it is. And it's so it's an epidemic. It destroys marriages. It's still the number one reason why people get divorced.
Yeah, awful. Well, you know, you've been at this for a number of years. What have you learned about some of the patterns that are involved in adultery eventually occurring? You write a lot about that in the book.
Yeah, well, generally speaking, very few Christians actually set out to do this. They don't start fishing, so to speak, like others might who aren't believers. But what happens usually is an emotional relationship begins to develop with somebody you work with or somebody you maybe work out with in a gym or at a club where you maybe work with kids or something of that nature, or maybe even just a ministry, maybe on a worship team or something. And it starts out with admiration. They do a good job, or you just kind of chit-chat. It's platonic friendship. But over time, it becomes more personal, and the conversation begins to shift a bit, and it becomes a mood-altering experience, and you begin to look forward to seeing that person. And you might even start dressing accordingly or making sure you look appropriate.
Yeah, right.
So at that point, you will take the conversation from external or outward into personal and what's going on the inside of you. And the very next step is you begin to save it, and you will use it as a secret stash to lift your mood and rule out your depression and calm down your anxiety.
Well, now this is interesting. When you talk about the beginnings often occurring with having emotional entanglements, or an emotional relationship begins like you just described, is it normally the case that somebody who will engage in an emotional relationship is already unhappy at home, or how does that break down? Is it just a matter of saying, oh, in addition to my husband, I can be friends with this guy, and it just goes from there?
It's more the latter. It really, because you share something in common with this person that you might not share with your spouse. I mean, obviously somebody at work is going to understand how you spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week, probably more than your spouse does. And maybe you sing in a worship team and your spouse doesn't sing at all. That's true in my marriage. Mm. I am not a musician. My wife is. So all marriages have voids that people have a tendency to connect with somebody of the opposite sex. And in this culture where men and women do so much together, it's just a matter of time until you face an attraction like this. I say to people all the time, you're either dead or in denial if you don't think this is going to happen to you, because it will in this culture.
Good grief. Now, what about the category of one-night stands? How common is it just for somebody to, you know, hook up with somebody one night?
Well, how common? You mean like percentages?
Percentage-wise.
I don't know that number, but yeah. I would tell you it's more common than we realize, and it usually happens in secrecy, and it often happens at professional conferences or reunions or things like that, and alcohol is almost always involved in this one.
Mm.
And these people don't have any emotional connection. They maybe share a meal, drink too much. They go back to the same hotel room. Maybe they're traveling for a corporation together. Those one night, David and Bathsheba, that's a beautiful, it's a perfect illustration of what happens in these one night stands.
Right. Well, now, when you look at this, you talk about the dangerous partner profile. I thought that was an interesting section of your book. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, about the person who might be attractive to you and how that all kind of plays out.
Well, a dangerous partner basically means this person who is so dangerous to you has bits and pieces of your own history and of the empty spots in your life, maybe from your family of origin. Maybe you never had a dad. Maybe your mom was a single mom working all the time. There wasn't a lot of nurturance. Or maybe in your marriage there are certain things missing that you've always wanted. Maybe you came from a family that really was very expressional, affection well, like an Italian community.
Right.
But you married somebody from Minnesota that never shows any affection. So hobbies and interests can pull people together. Personalities you've always admired but were maybe somewhat apprehensive about being too close to, but you always kind of looked up to them. There's all kinds of these bits and pieces that can be helpful to identify, because they will be protective. You will find people. You won't have to find them. They'll find you. There'll just be an automatic attraction when these kind of people cross your field of vision in difficult periods.
Well, and I would imagine with the advent of social media, it's that much worse, because you can get in touch now with people you knew in high school or people that you met on the job years ago. I mean, that's in a lot of ways, it seems a bad thing.
Well, that's the class five. The reestablishment of an old friendship, a romantic relationship. And the danger about that is the infatuation, the attraction. It's already stored in your brain. You don't have to grow it. It doesn't take any time to flourish or rekindle. In fact, we say if you stay in touch with an old girlfriend or boyfriend 30 days on the internet, you become confused about your marriage, because you will find the old infatuation coming back, and you'll say to yourself, my spouse doesn't do this for me. I mean, I don't feel like this when I talk with them. And if you stay another 30 days in touch, you'll find ways to sleep with them. Zero to 60. It'll take you down. That old infatuation is so powerful. You never forget stuff from adolescence. Never.
Well, now, when you have talked to people who have been involved in adulterous relationships, what are some of the commonalities among those people? Are they largely saying to you, I had no idea this would ever happen to me, as if they were victims, when in reality they have guilt, certainly. But how do they approach life? I mean, what sort of similarities do they have?
Well, one of the things we always ask, actually, when I first was on the research team, and we asked this question, is it possible for someone to be ignorantly and innocently prepared for adultery? That's a great question.
Yeah.
And the answer to that question is yes. Now, let's go back to Matthew when Jesus was tempted. When he went through that temptation and he was successful in resisting those temptations, a few verses at the end actually says, and the devil left him for a more opportune time.
Wow.
So you go through seasons in life, experiences in life that wear you down or erode your barriers and make you vulnerable. And there's all kinds of research to suggest that that's true.
Well, sure.
I'd be glad to share some of it with you if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you talk about Matthew 4, certainly this was an opportune time to attack Jesus. He was starving.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd not been eating.
Yeah. Worn out, exhausted, yeah.
Yeah, all by himself, too. Didn't have anybody around
him. Yeah, exactly. But the devil didn't win, and he said, I'll wait till another better time to try again. I mean, the devil is relentless.
Yeah, he really is. And that's another thing that, and I want to get into this more when we come back from the break, because there really is a spiritual component to it also. We always have the devil as our accuser. He's the one who tempts us. Come on, sin, sin, sin. And then once you sin, he accuses you, rotten, dirty, filthy thing. You can never be forgiven. This is how the enemy works. But yes, I absolutely want to get more from you on this issue of high risk times and opportune times that you mentioned as setting people up to commit adultery. We're going to come back with Dave Carter, Anatomy of an Affair is his book. We'll be right back. 2 million refugees are in Lebanon today, living in disease-ridden tent settlements. Most of them are children. But through Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, these children are getting a Christian education and meals and hearing about Jesus for the first time. When you call 866-485-9187 with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue four of these children. And right now, your gift will be matched by a ministry friend. These little ones need your assistance. Please call now. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or JanetMefford.com.
From Paramount Pictures and PureFlix comes Same Kind of Different as Me. Ron and Debbie Hall have everything they could ever want, except for a loving marriage. But when Debbie befriends a homeless man, their lives begin to intersect, and they are all changed forever.
Amazing how far a little 10 or 11 care can go.
Same Kind of Different as Me, based on the true story, now playing, rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. More information is available at SameKindOfDifferentAsMeMovie.com.
Are you a responsible person who finds yourself growing deeper and deeper in credit card debt and you're not sure how to fix the problem? Then get ready for a toll-free number that will put you on a path to financial recovery. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that will consolidate your accounts into one easy-to-manage monthly payment. Put a stop to late fees and over-limit charges, reduce your interest rates by as much as 60%, and possibly improve your credit score. You'll save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. It's not a loan. It's a smart way to relieve your stress, meet your obligations, and preserve your self-respect. If your debt has you down, gather up your bills and call this toll-free number for a free, no-obligation debt analysis. 1-800-793-8752. Call now. 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752.
We are back on Janet Mefford today. Thank you for joining us. The statistics are really shocking about adultery, even in the church. And we're talking about The Anatomy of an Affair. It's the name of the book by Dave Carter, who is joining us, pastor of counseling ministries at First Evangelical Free Church of Fullerton, California. So we were talking a little bit about Matthew 4 and how the devil was tempting Christ after he was fasting in the wilderness all alone, exhausted. And as you mentioned, scripture says the devil left him for a more opportune time. How does that carry over into the lives of people that you've talked to and what you've seen in your years of counseling?
Well, first of all, we all bring vulnerable spots. I have asthma. Asthma's been in my family for three generations. In fact, the first three generations died from it. So there's a risk factor in my genetic structure for asthma. So there's also risk factors that all of us bring to this, and that the book kind of focuses on some of them. We can go into them if you want to, but they get a little more complicated. Maybe we have time for today. But secondly, you go through seasons, stressful periods of time. And I talked to you about that, some of that research. You can Google this. It's called misattribution of attraction. It's a crazy foreign name. But what it basically means is when you go through high stress periods of time, you are more likely to succumb. You are more likely to fail. This researcher constructed two footbridges, identical in nature. One was wired and bolted down tightly. The other was swaying and very shaky, and you had to hang on as you crossed it. He marched college boys across it, put a college co-ed at the end of the bridge, marched the guys across. They rated how attractive the college co-ed was. Brought them back the next afternoon, marched them across the shaky bridge, put the same college co-ed at the end of the bridge, used the same survey sheet. Guess when the college co-ed was more attractive?
When it was shaky.
When it was shaky. Because when you're under great stress, you are looking for two things, and all first-time affairs are about it: comfort and distraction. Always. Always.
Wow.
So here she is at the end of the bridge, and you think there's going to be some great comfort, and she's never as good as she looks, or he isn't either, when you go through stress.
Yeah.
But you're vulnerable.
You're vulnerable to it. Well, when you talk about the risk factors, I'd love for you to go through some of those, just so people can get an idea of what sorts of things do put you at risk.
Well, you can take some of the personal items that you have. For instance, we did this research. That's what we were looking for. What kind of risk factors do people bring to the table? And I want to stress, it doesn't make you do it. It just creates a vulnerability so you'll recognize it. So if you have a family history of infidelity, you are more likely to act out. If you come from a single-parent blended family because of the broken attachment issues, you are more likely to act out in adulthood. If you come from a home with chronic conflict or addiction, you are more likely to act out. We know four things bust marriages: addiction, abuse, abandonment, and adultery. Those four A's destroy attachment within the marriage bond. So then you've got the whole idea of, if you have a molestation history, that's going to be a factor in there. If you have attention deficit disorders, which are hyperactivity, there's often a lot of impulsivity and lack of impulse control. And those kids go through childhood experiences unliked and being picked on and maybe disciplined more because they're so impulsive. And so there's a great need for comfort. There's a great need for distraction in their lives. 50%, we actually say, about of pregnancies in America. Let me say it differently. That's not quite right. First, the ratio of first-time affairs, 50% of them occur while the wife is pregnant or in the first year after delivery. Now, you just think about it. It makes all the sense in the world because of the first trimester nausea, morning sickness. You don't feel like being loving and kind.
No.
Your body shape is changing. Your hormones are changing. Your emotional focus is changing. There might be some bed rest requirements. There might be, after the baby is born, some of the kind of sexual restrictions. It just goes on. Sleep deprivation, you're exhausted. And the other thing is, that mom, if she nurses that baby, she will have the highest levels of oxytocin in her life.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
So she is emotionally satisfied. Actually, there wouldn't be any second borns if there wasn't oxytocin.
I can attest to that. That's a really good point. So again,
yeah,
you're getting down to these vulnerable periods of time. And of course, when we're talking about Christians, though, we know that adultery is sin. We know it's wrong. Mm-hmm. We have these moral boundaries. You think of the old Billy Graham rule, and people make fun of it. Oh, he didn't want to get into an elevator with any woman who wasn't his wife. Oh, how quaint. What about some of the boundaries that need to be part of our lives as Christians? Because even though we're Christians, we're human. What do we do as far as boundaries?
Yeah. Well, the first boundaries, the whole concept of protecting yourself has gone through a series of developments. The first one were vows, where you made promises
to
each other.
Right.
But this generation, they don't trust people's word. Their dad walked out on the family. Their mom walked out on the family. So they don't trust anybody, what anyone says. So vows are insufficient. Well, rings came along. So we have a visual symbol. But rings actually create what we call marriage poaching. Somebody comes along who's single, looks at somebody with a ring, thinks to themselves, you know what? You made her happy. Maybe you can make me happy instead.
Mm.
And poaching is on the rise. 50% of singles in a recent survey said they had tried to attract an already married person.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then along came boundaries and hedges and doors and windows, kind of passive restraints. I love them. There's nothing wrong with them. But very few people understand the risk factors they bring from inside of them and their background into these kind of experiences. And then, of course, our culture is growing to what we call two seductive personality types, the narcissist and the borderline.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I think about the porn problem, and I wonder how much that leads into problems as well, because our culture has been so sexualized and over-sexualized, and I'm sure that plays a factor as well.
Oh, did you see the cover of Time magazine about 8 months ago where there are five young men on it, newly married, who could not be sexual with their spouses because they'd seen too much porn in their lives before?
Oh, my. It's tragic.
Yeah, you're right. It's a terribly destructive process. And to not be aroused by seeing your spouse because you've seen too many naked people, there's not a lot of hope for our culture.
No, absolutely. What about this issue of men and women being friends and whether or not you should get close to somebody or, you know, really watch what you do or how much you have any sort of emotional attachment to a member of the opposite sex you're not married to?
Well, I recommend two things. First of all, if you're married, I would encourage you to practice the contract that's listed at the back of the book, where you and your spouse acknowledge this is a dangerous culture, And if I feel attracted, I promise to bring it up and not hide it, for us to talk through and figure out what this is all about. And I won't get angry if I hear this. I have several points in there. I think you need to do that on the front end of your marriage. The second thing, when you get involved in these friendships, and many times you bring them into the marriage, meaning you've been friends with this guy in the group you ran around with for 10 years, and you only have known your spouse 3 years.
Right.
So you automatically bring this tendency to share with someone who knows you better to the table. You just bring it to the table. I think the other side of it is you have to be really honest, really honest. If your conversation with this friend begins to move from external events, professional experiences, to internal feelings and experiences that are very personal, then you are already on a slippery slide.
Right.
You are honest, because you're going to starve the marriage and you're going to feed the friendship. You're going to feed the relationship that's feeding you. That's the way it works.
Well, and the thing about it's such a trap, because you fell in love with your spouse for a certain list of reasons, and that person is wonderful. But when you're living with another sinner day in and day out, you're going to fight. You're going to have conflict. It's just a part of life. It's not as if Superman's going to swing down. Oh, he seems so wonderful, and he'll be much better than my husband. I mean, it's just it's a lie and a trap. And again, we're back to the devil just tempting us and lying to us.
Yeah, you know? I agree with you. We often say millennials are putting off marriage, always hoping a better person's right around the corner to fix them, to heal their hurts, to solve their problems. But the issue is you need to become a better person. You're not looking for a better person. You just need to be a better person yourself.
Absolutely. And have that kind of godly character. That's so important. And you have some really good tools in here. You mentioned this contract in the book, Anatomy of an Affair. People can read that and take a look at that. And I think that is so helpful, Dave, because it's wrecked so many marriages and destroyed so many families. And I think Christians will be really grateful for this kind of guidance.
Yeah, well, the whole field of treating adultery is less than 25 years old.
Boy, well, it's high time. High time. Yeah. Let me give the book out again. It's called Anatomy of an Affair. Dave Carter, who's been with us today. And it was great to have you. Dave, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
I'm glad to. Look forward to it again, maybe in the future.
You got it. That sounds good. God bless you. And thanks again for being here. Thank you for listening to Janet Mefford today. Always a pleasure to have you aboard. We'll see you next time. God bless.